May 28th. Mrs. Brown's advice about the schoolgirls, they won't bite. I took her word on that and left the house for the first time in a while to wander up to the cemetery. A belated outing for Mother's birthday. It always seems important to go somewhere for her sake. But she is nowhere any longer, least of all the Riverside Cemetery. Even the writer O. Henry has up and gone from here, as Mrs. Brown would say. Tom Wolfe is still in situ, though the town is evidently still put out with him. Many graves bore jars of wilting peonies today, but nary a posy for poor Tom, a man so recently gone, dramatically and in his prime, reeling from the fracas of fame. Maybe Mrs. Brown could have saved him. A sample of one day's mail, posted forward from Stratford and Sons, received on June 6, 1946, 6 months after publication of Vassals of Majesty, spelling S-I-C, signed V.B. Dear Mr. Shepherd, your book, Vassals of Majesty, is tops. I sobbed my heart out hundreds of times, especially at the end when the soldiers burnt up all the king's parrots in the fire. My mother had a parakeet named Mickey Rooney. My sister never stopped razzing me because I stayed up all night, scared out of my wig on the gory parts. Then she read it and blew her top. I think Lieutenant Remedios is a dreamboat, but she is all for Cuautla. Which one is supposed to be the best? I am a budding author, too. Please send an autograph photo and keep it coming. My sister says, two, please. Thanks, Lindsay Parks. Dear Mr. Shepherd, I am writing about your book in regards to the war in Mexico. Usually I sit on the fence and don't argue with people or try to tell them how it is. The horror of war is part of life since recorded history. But your book showed how men really feel when they are soldiers. I served in the 12th Infantry Regiment, F Company, one of the few that made it out of Burdorf. I read your book in the Van Wyck Army Hospital. About 10 other guys on my ward read your book, and most of the others couldn't hold a book or see to read one. Everything about war is bad, like you said. Some of us have a bet that you were an infantry man yourself. Yours truly, George M. Cook. Dear Mr. Shepherd, my name is Eleanor White, and I reside in Springfield, Missouri. I am currently attending college at Webster Women's College. I myself am not a big reader, but I must say, your book made me want to read more, more, more. Now I understand the Mexican conquistadors through new eyes. I am recommending my history professor to read it. My hat is off to you. Yours truly, Eleanor White. Dear Mr. Harrison, my name is Gary Duncan, and I live in California. My girlfriend was hanging icicles all over me until I read your book, Vessels of Majesty. In a word, stimulating. I found your descriptions very thought-provoking, even if I didn't think it is the best book ever wrote. But am I going to tell Shelley that? I would be tops in her book if you sent a photo. Her birthday is coming up here quick, June 14th. Her name is Shelley. And the last name? Same as yours, Harrison. Can you top that? Your friend, Gary. Dear Mr. Shepherd, I would like to say thank you. Your writing is an inspiration to us all, or anyway, that is how I feel. Your book hit me when it made me think how the boys on both sides of the war were still human, whether Spanish or the Mexicans. Every person is human, even Japs. Their mothers must have all cried tears just the same. That gave me something to ponder. Please continue to write more books. Yours sincerely, Alice Kendall. All correspondence answered with a short note, no photographs or inclusions. V.B. July 6, 1946. Dear Diego, I trust Frida is still recovering from the surgery in New York. I have no address for her there, but could not let her birthday pass. I expect she is angry with me for failing to visit. Please forward my saludos and tell her I never fail to bake a rosca in her honor on this day, whether she is present to eat it or not. On the eve of your elections, I share your thrill and dread, waiting to see what Mexico will declare for herself and her revolution. The news is sparse, so I welcome any from you. I did read of the National Prize of Arts and Sciences, and so I congratulate you both. Your wife is a national prize herself, as you know better than anyone. The news from here is about what you'd expect. You wouldn't care for the food. No empanadas dulces. I doubt there is a tablespoon of sugar right now in all Asheville. My cake today with molasses and pureed apples was a sad, dark brown cousin of its predecessors. But rations are lifted on nearly everything else. Prices rise like balloons, and we all jump like children under a piñata, reaching for our material passions. Americans believe in waterproof gabardine and Vim's vitamin tablets. The housewives sent their butter to the front for years and now require their heavenly reward. To get it all manufactured on schedule, the sacrifice of laborers will have to be made permanent, it seems. They toiled like slaves for the war effort and still haven't had a single pay adjustment. You could have heard a wrench drop on Pack Square this spring when the unions shut down everything. But Truman seized the railroad and drafted the strikers into military service to command them back to work. So that is the report you asked for. Not entirely good. Our newsmen mostly reviled the workers' rebellion. Politics here now resemble a pillow fight. Lacking the unifying slogan, "Win the War," our opposing parties sling absurd pronouncements back and forth, which everyone pretends carry real weight. How the feathers fly! The newsmen leap on anything, though it's all on the order of 4 out of 5 shoppers know this is the better dill pickle. Assertions that can't be proven, but sway opinion. Dance for the crowd is the new order, with newsmen leading the politicians like bears on the leash. Real convictions would be a hindrance. The radio is at the root of the evil. Their rule is no silence ever. When anything happens, the commentator has to speak without a moment's pause for gathering wisdom. Falsehood and inanity are preferable to silence. You can't imagine the effect of this. The talkers are rising above the thinkers. On my own advice, then, I'll close this ramble. But first, I have a confession. The day I left Mexico 6 years ago, Frida gave me your copy of the Codex Botarini. She said it was a gift from you, and gladly I accepted. But I wonder, did she actually ask, or just tell you it was stolen? The culprit herein revealed. The cook. In this parcel I enclose it, rightfully returned. You may remember I was enthralled by this codex, which you showed me in your office one day. I understood it to be a sort of Bible for the homeless. Yet, with its little drawings of people, it also resembled the 8-pagers the boys used to have at school. And I'm abashed to admit, your codex had more effect on me than the naked Sally Rand ever did. When Frida put its accordion folds in my hand, I couldn't refuse. I should have asked her whether you'd been informed of your generosity, but I wanted it badly and took it for this reason. In my experience, penitence is more attainable than permission. I hope you'll be pleased to know I made good use of it. My second novel, now complete, is the story of the Mexica people's journey to their new home in the Promised Valley, where the eagle tears the snake, my tentative title. Plot and dramatic interest all came directly from the Codex. All those severed heads on stakes, fur-covered enemies, and eagles flying down to carry weapons to the rescue. I hardly needed to invent a thing. It was much like working as your typist. I only had to stay awake to a luminous presence and make a good transcription. so I'm in debt to you, not to mention the original author of the codex, attributed to Huitzilopochtli himself. I will soon send the manuscript to my publisher and receive a check for royalties on advance. If the feather-headed god expects his share, he had better get in contact right away. With regards to all in your household, H. Shepherd. July 8, 1946. The manuscript sailed off today. Mrs. Brown took it to the post office. Before going out the door, she turned back and held out the bulky brown paper package of it, resting flat on her white-gloved hands. "Look here, Mr. Shepherd, a little raft with all your hopes upon it, sailing for New York. You know not how light it feels in my hands." This afternoon she discovered my birth date had just passed. She is filing old documents, the birth certificate applications and so forth, now that the flurry of typing is done. She seemed hurt. "A man turns 30 years, that's important," she scolded. "And to think I sat here and knew naught of it all the day long." I didn't say what Frida would have, that you can't really know the person standing before you, because always there is some missing piece. The birthday, like an invisible piñata hanging great and silent over his head as he stands in his slippers boiling the water for coffee. The scarred, shrunken leg hidden under a green silk dress. A wife and son back in France. Something you never knew. That is the heart of the story. August 27th. Murderous dreams come even in daytime, memories that occlude vision. How can a friend's blood be willed from the mind? Other men do it. They come home from a war, kiss the ground, and go forward as easily as taking the Haywood bus to the library, without meeting this rising panic and humiliation. Running out of the library bookless and hatless, rather than end up crumpled behind the newspaper stacks again, watching blood spread across the maple floorboards. Last week, on the day itself, even the bedroom was too uncertain a place, its shifting walls and windows glare, letting in the clouded sky. Mrs. Brown thought it must be the grip. She brought tea and toast upstairs on a tray. Today, 110 paces to the corner market, step by counted step. An automobile passed slowly on the street, a Buick. Two women at the newsstand professed themselves as admirers. One had just come from the market and carried a bouquet of gladiolus wrapped in a paper cone. She meant no harm at all. She was only a young wife going home to some celebration. Not Jackson Mornard, stalking Frida in Paris, arms loaded with flowers. Any fool could know the difference. But anyone who rises, any greatness, attracts those who would cut it down at the root. Any fool knows that also. Every day it seems possible to walk to the door. This time, step out. But the sidewalk leads to a bridge across a precipice. There is Mother up ahead, slipping off her slingback shoes, stepping out onto the planks above the rushing ravine. "Don't come. You wait here." The red-bellied spider pulls itself into a hole in the plank. Every hole could have something like that inside. Mrs. Brown might know more than she says. Today she looked up from the table, peering over her glasses to size up her wretched, captive chief, who stands at the door looking out. "They won't bite," she said. "But it isn't the girls in saddle Oxfords. It is the things that have already begun, proceeding now toward their finish. The supplicant who should have been turned away and was not. The man at the door with hat in hand, and the pickaxe under his raincoat. September 2nd. No word from Frida, still angry. Nor from Diego, not even a curse over his stolen codex, though that's also to be expected. He couldn't remember to write letters, even as chairman general of Lev's correspondence committee. The world is a train moving forward, with people like Diego and Frida at the fore, and all the rest of us standing back, shuddering at the roar. Of all those gone away, Frida is the most missed. Not that she ever offered real affection. Only her version of it, a game of cat and mouse. September 3rd. Well, here is a reason for missing Frida. Writing letters. Who else loved my news the way she did? A neighbor named Romulus. Now, a sister named Parthenia. Don't trouble yourself over it. That's my sister, Parthenia Goins, said Mrs. Brown today, hardly even looking up from the page she was typing. Her husband Oddie is out there too, I see, and some of the nephews. I'd just told her a band of gypsies had come to the end of their rope on Montford Avenue and were camped on the front yard. Very chagrined, therefore, to learn it was Mrs. Brown's family, come down into town from the Hells. A twice yearly event, at Eastertide and the Laboring Day, for the purchase of dry goods and a checkup on the moral progress of Sister Violet. The trip takes them the better part of a day, even though they live only a few miles up toward Mount Mitchell. But the road, she says, is fearsome hateful. They showed up out there at noon, in a Model T that looked older than God and more likely to drop an axle. The man in the driving seat opened the door to stretch his legs, revealing a beard that reached his belt buckle. Clumped in the back, an old-looking woman and shifting herd of ox-like boys. They sat in the car for hours, until the heat drove them out into the shade of the maple in the front yard. They showed no sign of coming to the door. Mrs. Brown said they likely meant to fetch her back to Mrs. Biddle's and were waiting for her day's work to end. Shouldn't we ask them in? They won't come. Well, then, you should go. I'm not done here. It won't vex them any to wait. For hours, Mrs. Brown? I peered out through the curtain. Couldn't they do some errands and come back to save their time? Mr. Shepherd, if they had any money or one precious thing, they'd be sure to save it. But time they have aplenty. They like to spend it where they be. Realizing they might have come to investigate Sister Violet's situation, I did insist on asking them in. Elder Sister accepted, eventually, while the males remained outdoors, all of them smoking pipes. Mrs. Brown introduced us, but begged a few minutes more to finish the week's work. The sister, Parthenia, what a strange creature, peering about this living room like Columbus among the red men of Hispaniola. She sat in a parlor chair with feet together, hands folded, a black kerchief covering her hair, a lumpish dress covering everything else down to her boots. Not even Frida could have worked this particular peasant style to much advantage. She declined my offer of tea, fiercely, as if accustomed to being poisoned by strangers. We sat facing one another across the shocking silence. Finally, "Who mought ye all be?" "I beg your pardon?" "Who's your folks?" "My parents both passed away. I don't have any family." She took this in slowly, like a snake digesting its catch. Then, "How old be ye?" 30. Many other questions stood in line after these, each patiently waiting its turn, each one finally spitting, rubbing its hands, and stepping up to position. "Violet says ye be from Mexico?" "I lived there. But I was born outside Washington. My mother was Mexican. Her father did business with the government here, so that's how she and my father came to meet. She was too young. The family disowned her over the marriage." "Stop!" Filling up a silence with blather, like a radio man. That cannot be what a Parthenia requires.
Weel?
A pause. What brung ye up this our way off the branch? A good question. Trying to steer the conversation onto her family proved difficult, but ultimately yielded Parthenia's fascinating diagnosis of Sister Violet's yen for self-improvement. Our mother read the books. We believe it made her tubercular. A long pause. Violet be the same. Another pause. We was all in our family borned with sense, but Violet be the only one to vex herself on wanting to be learned. Borned, learned. Here was the raw version of Violet's peculiar diction, without the gloss acquired from 20 years of office work. We was afeared she would turn out like t'other one, the lady doctor that was borned here in the town. Elizabeth Blackwell? That one. Violet reading a book on her. Mother was afeared of her going away to be learned for the doctrine. That would have been an interesting career for your sister.
Not hardly, sir. 'Twould have put her in a hazard of hell's fire.
Medical school? To be learned for the science, yes, sir. Them men casting aspersion on our Lord's hand in the creation. In the dining room, visible through the archway, Sister Violet's lip remained buttoned, but her eyebrows nearly reached her widow's peak by the time she finished filing the day's mail. Parthenia took her away then, evidently satisfied the new employer would not threaten her sister's virtue or encourage any interest in the sciences. It explains a good deal about Mrs. Brown, her aloneness in the world, as far from home in this town as any boy from Mexico, probably farther, given the scalding disapproval of anything learned. And yet she does carry her origins with her, revealed in the rhythms of speech, the talent for keeping counsel, the unusual respect for silence. Parthenia's silences outlasted her sentences every time and carried greater weight. How will their tongue survive in a modern world where the talkers rush to trample every pause? September 14th. Mr. Lincoln Barnes, my Mr. Lincoln, he means well. A second novel makes me a novelist, says he, and therefore duty-bound to meet my editor in New York. He can't know how entirely it's out of the question. He should invite me to dance with angels on the head of a pin. I'd sooner try if I could do it from home. But my failure will mean conceding every battle, beginning with my title, Where the Eagle Eats the Snake. Wrong, he pronounced yesterday on the telephone. People hate snakes. Well then, wouldn't they be happy to see an eagle tearing one to pieces sitting on a cactus plant? The dust jacket art seems ready-made. He is keen to call it Pilgrims of Chapultepec. Americans take pilgrim to mean the fellow in buckled shoes with hands folded in prayer, and the unpronounceable remainder as dubious as Brand X soap. Mrs. Brown suggests that for the next one, I ought to turn in the manuscript with a title I despise. That way, she says, they're apt to change it to something you favor, a trick she learned while working for the U.S. Army. September 26th. The exhibit, Advancing American Art, is advancing at this very moment toward the National Gallery, packed up on the train with Tom Cuddy as its shipping shepherd. And still I have no answer for him. Tommy the Golden Boy, with the good looks of Van Huysenoort and a better idea how to use them. It's possible he has never been turned down before. On the telephone, he coaxes. Says I have to be there in D.C. He's desperate for backup, certain there is trouble afoot. Congress has called a special hearing to discuss the exhibit after they've had a look at it. And what Tommy said about the Hearst Press is true.
Mrs. Brown brought in one of their magazine ads today, a reproduction of one of what they call the ugly paintings, with the caption, "Your money bought this." They suggest a foregone conclusion among soap-buying housewives. Your money would be better spent on soap. But with Mrs. Brown, their propaganda failed. She is now intently curious about the show. Paris with Tommy, dear Lord, what a vision. He was dazzling enough in a dim boxcar. But surely he'll understand there is too much to do here, revisions and galley proofs still ahead. He'll be less willing to understand why Washington is out of the question. To have a look at those modernists, have a drink with old Tom, help him ship out the paintings? Patiently, Mrs. Brown waits to send an answer, yes or no. Probably she has already drafted both letters and only needs the word. Such is her efficiency. We discussed it again this afternoon, or rather, I talked, justifying my absurd fear of travel and exposure, despising it all the while. My face must have been the picture of Dorian Gray at the end when he goes to pieces. She used the quiet voice she seems to draw up from a different time, the childhood in mountain hells, I suppose. What do ye fear will happen? There was no sound but the clock in the hall. Tick, tick. Mr. Shepherd, ye cannot stop a bad thought from coming into your head, but ye need not pull up a chair and bide it sit down. October 2nd. The matter is settled, the letter sent. Mrs. Brown provided the solution, herself. She will go along on the trip, make all arrangements, reserve the hotel rooms for both of us in names no one could recognize. No girls in short socks will gather in the halls. We will take the roadster. She'll carry the money purse and purchase the gasoline. No strangers need be addressed on the journey. Only Tom, once we arrive at the gallery. Indispensable Mrs. Brown. She has known all along the problem is not the grip. But couldn't know how her firm hand on my arm could make many things possible, including walking out the door onto that swaying bridge. It appeared you needed steadying, was her diagnosis. October 12th. Poor Tom, and also the 40-odd artists who will suffer from this, but somehow I worry most for Tom. He believed in advancing American art, and not just the free ride to Europe. Now he has to hang his head, call Paris and Prague, and explain the show isn't coming. They will dismantle it, sell off these treasures to the first low bid so the Department of State can recover the taxpayers' cash. The boss will make Tommy do the worst of it. The O'Keefe already went for $50, he said, salt in the wound. Mrs. Brown and I were more than ready to put miles between ourselves and that debacle. But the journey home was long. The mountain parkway is a strange passage from city into wilderness, hundreds of miles of forest and vale without habitation. Occasionally an apple orchard, fenced by a zigzag of split rails, like a piece of green calico cut with pinking shears. Driving along high ridgetops is like being a bird on the wing, with slopes dropping steeply away from the roadsides and views opening out to rumpled, hazy horizons. The leaves were crimson, auburn, jade, and gold, lying together in patchwork against the mountainsides. God's hand bestoweth beauty on the advancing trial of winter, Mrs. Brown quoted. But it looked as if God had turned over the job to a Mexican muralist. When first I made this drive, the forests were leafless. I told Mrs. Brown about it. Father unexpectedly dead, and then this endless passage into a barren wilderness. I thought I had come to a nation of the interred. Then you came to Miss Biddle's, she said, and knew it for certain. Old Judd seemed mummified, true enough, but certainly not you or Miss McKellar. Each time we stopped for gasoline, she insisted we take on coffee and sandwiches as well. Feed the car, feed the driver, was her succinct advice. The gray mass of a storm sat on the mountains to the west, waiting like a predator. In the afternoon, it pounced, drenching the view and washing the brilliant leaves into matted sop in the road. The rain on the windscreen was blinding. The wiper had to be cranked every few seconds, and it made for difficult one-handed driving. Mrs. Brown offered to help turn the wiper lever, but its location overhead above the driver makes that awkward. "Mr. Ford should have thought to put it over here," she said, "so the passenger could help." He knew better. In life's dampest passages, the driver often has to go it alone. "I ought to know that. Here knitting socks without one child of my own." "Is that what you have there? I thought it was an indigo porcupine." She had a laugh at that. She has 11 nephews and nieces, I learned, and meant to outfit the tribe on this journey, working through socks from top to toe, all from the same massive hank of blue wool. The coming holiday shall be known as the Christmas of the Blue Socks from Aunt Violet. She worked on a little frame of 4 interlocked needles that poked out in every direction as she passed the yarn through its rounds. "Aren't you afraid you'll hurt yourself with that?" "Mr. Shepherd, if women feared knitting needles as men do, the world would go bare naked." What had happened in Washington was an outrage. Yet life goes forward mostly as an exchange of pleasantries on a narrow bridge that hangs above the chasm of outrage. There's Grandfather Mountain. See the shape of it, an old man lying down. "Is it too cold for you? We could stop and get the lap blanket from the back." "No, I'm warm-blooded." "We're lucky it's cold. This roadster overheats famously on hard inclines." "You don't say." Grand white clappered hotels turned up sparsely along the route, their front porches mostly populated with empty rocking chairs. At dusk, they began to be lit by the yellow glow of lamplight. Once, just as we passed an inn, a black-skinned man in a red jacket was lighting the porch lanterns one by one, leaning with difficulty around elegant men who sat idle, smoking cigars. Casts of the nation. Mrs. Brown finally broached the void. "Indigo porcupine. That could just as well be the name of one of those paintings we saw at the show." "Yes, indigo porcupine leaping into the void. That might do." "Well, I couldn't make out what all they were meant to be. Truly, I've never seen the like, Mr. Shepherd, but I'm deeply obliged for it." "I wasn't going to come until you volunteered as escort, so I'm the one obliged." "For all, I meant. The paintings and our nation's capital. Going right straight in the hall where the Congress meets." "Had you not been to Washington before?" "This is my first time out of Buncombe County."
"Really?"
"Yes, sir. I've read the geographics since I was a girl. My sisters could tell you. I strained for travel like a horse fresh to the bit, but never thought it would happen." "Mrs. Brown, you make me ashamed. The whole world knocks at my door, and all I want to do is stay home." "It's a wonder," she said tactfully, working at a tiny sock. "Well, you're a worldlier person than most of those congressmen. They want Norman Rockwell and statues of muscular horses and nothing new under the sun." "Even still, there was no cause to speak so rudely. What peeved them?" "Fear, maybe. The foreign element, that's what Tom thought. They expected to go in the gallery and see old friends, but instead they met strangers, gashes of color and surrealism. It made them uneasy."
"They didn't say uneasy. They said un-American. I can't see that. If an American paints it, then it's American, isn't it?"
"Not according to Mr. Rankin and the Congress."
"Or Truman.
If that's art, then I'm a Hottentot." "Others said vulgar, obscene, insane, namby-pamby pacifism. or Stalinist, a perfect irony from these congressmen who seemed as determined as Stalin to suppress creativity among artists. The show scared them out of their wits. The special session was a thrashing. Mrs. Brown, we should have taken Tom out of that hearing. It was humiliating.
Your poor friend. He'd worked so. He'll take it hard, will he not?
Oh, believe me. Tom Cuddy feels for those paintings about the way you do for your nieces and nephews. He'd knit socks for Winslow Homer if he knew how. I've seen that in him ever since the civilian services. Moving paintings and sculptures to safekeeping, that was America the Beautiful for Tom. That was patriotism.
Bless his heart.
Bless it, indeed. Now he's had to hear Congress declare the whole Western world threatened by some paint and canvas. Our finest painters, a menace. One was specifically damned for having urged Roosevelt to come to the aid of the Soviet Union and Britain after Hitler attacked Russia, which, in fact, Roosevelt did. The click of knitting needles, the shush of tires through leafy muck. The lozenge of space inside the automobile felt surprisingly safe, like a small home moving through a tunnel of darkness. Mrs. Brown finished off a sock before speaking again.
Not all the pictures were hard to cipher. Some were plain. The ones with cemeteries and tenement houses got people the most riled, if you ask me, more than the ones that looked like dribble-drabble.
You mean the Guglielmi and those?
Why do you think?
Congress has to keep up appearances. The paintings were going around the world. We can't let them know we have racial strife and tenement houses.
My stars, Mr. Shepherd, Europe is lying in a pile. On the news, they said Berlin City just dug 2,000 graves for the ones that aim to starve to death before spring.
A car blazed by, two bright eyes in the dark.
They had to dig the graves before the ground froze, she added.
I understand.
In London, no better. I read they're allowed not but 4 ounces of knitting wool for the year and 2 yards of material to cover each person in a family. They must be about naked. What's the harm in those folks seeing some of our troubles?
Well, 5 years of wartime censorship. Old habits die hard. We've gotten very good at pretending everything is shipshape here. Don't you feel that way?
What way?
That it's a little dangerous to advertise our weak points? Jerry and Tokyo Rose might be listening. Loose lips sink ships.
They were listening, but the war's ended.
True. But if it keeps the paintings pretty and all people's whining buttoned up, maybe they'll want a new war every 5 years.
Mr. Shepherd, for shame. That is no subject for jest. We can't keep on forever saying the nation entire is perfect, because between you and me, sir, it is not.
The needles clicked in the dark. She must have read the pattern with her fingertips. Do you remember the first advice you ever gave me?
She seemed to think it over. The pot roast at Ms. Biddle's?
Advice about writing.
I never.
Oh, you did. In that first letter, you said Tom Wolfe got himself in hot water exposing the scandals of Asheville, and I was wise to keep my story in Mexico. Here was your advice. People love to read about sins and errors, but not their own.
She considered this. That's different from putting sins and errors off the map entire. How can it be un-American to paint a picture of sadness?
I don't know, but they did not want to see any waves on the domestic waters. For several minutes, she knitted at her sock, evidently struggling not to say more. At length, she lost the battle.
If you're standing in the manure pile, it's somebody's job to mention the stink. Those congressmen are saying we have to call it a meadow of buttercups instead of a cesspool. Even the artists have to.
Well, but suppose the artist's job is just to keep everyone amused. maybe get their minds off the stink by calling it a meadow. Where's the harm?
Nobody will climb out of the pile. There's the harm.
They'll keep where they are, deep to the knees in dung, trying to outdo each other, remarking on the buttercups.
Well, I write historical romance. I'm sorry to let you down, but any time you're looking for the meadow and buttercups, I'm your man.
Fiddlesticks, Mr. Shepherd. Do you think I ken ye not?
Do you know me? I suppose you do. Well enough.
Well enough. You are good to children whose parents are not. You take in the straggliest cats. You are dismayed by the treatment of the Negro. You read more newspapers than Mr. Hurst himself, though it aggravates you to no end. Shifflin' through all that claptrap, hunting a day's won glory, the rise of the little man somewhere, or the fall of a tyrant.
Is that everything?
About. I believe you stand on the side of the Union of Labor.
Well done, Mrs. Brown. You can read me like a book.
Even in the full darkness, I could feel her glare, the dangerous force of her. She had those needles.
Set your photograph on the dust cover or not. It makes no difference. You are still there, Mr. Shepherd, plain to see. Your first one was about the hatefulness of war. Everyone said so. How it fills up the rich men's pockets and grieves the poor ones.
I see.
You needn't squirm, Mr. Shepherd. Your words are your own wee bairns. You need not leave them orphaned. You should stand up proud and say, "Those are mine."
Soon we passed through the long tunnel at Little Switzerland, a deeper darkness within the night's blue darkness, like a cave in the sea. Mrs. Brown's knitting stayed in her lap, the strange blue bundle with its armature of needles, like a peculiar pet she could no longer bear to touch. When we reached Mrs. Biddle's, she said goodbye. But until then we hardly spoke any more. Both driver and passenger seemed to need all our energies to find the way ahead, staring at the bleakness and the rain. November 15th. A letter from Frida after all this time, opened with trembling hands. Thrill and fear are really the same inside a body. Her operation, a partial success, good news, though she still suffers. The handsome Spaniard she met in New York seems to be good medicine, a sturdy platform from which to forgive. Her grammar was so odd, though, barely coherent. The date on the letter was Lev's birthday and the day of the October Revolution, but no mention of either. No more red carnations on the table for old loves, the viejo, and democratic socialism. Diego has gone over completely to the side of the Stalinists now, and she, perhaps, to the side of morphine. December 24th. A gift. Knitted gloves of soft gray wool. What a remarkable sensation to slide them on and feel each finger fit perfectly in its allotted space. "I noticed ye have none," she said, "or wear none. I thought maybe they didn't use them in Mexico." "I've bought 3 pairs since I moved here, and they're all too short in the fingers. I wind up with webbed hands like a duck."
"Well, see, I wondered. Your fingers are about twice what God gave the rest of us."
I held out both gloved hands, stunned by the sight of perfection. "How did you do this? Did you measure me in my sleep?"
She grinned. "A grease stain on one of your ladders. You must have leaned on the table to stand up after eating a bacon sandwich."
"Very impressive."
I brought in a rule and measured all the fingers. I turned my hands over, admiring the row of slant stitches across each thumb gusset.
"Not blue, though? I thought you specialized in indigo."
"Oh, those socks, you mean, out of that cheap handspun. Those were for the children. This is pure merino from Belk's. I can use quality on you because you're not planning to outgrow these in a year or run holes in them on purpose. I'll try not to let you down. A memory of snow. A hill striped sideways with blue shadows of trees. Screaming. The thrill of pursuit. Some adult lobbing white balls, making the sound of a cannon blast with every volley. Cupping up hard snow that leaves pills of ice clinging to the fuzzy palms. Mittens, red with a snowflake pattern across the knuckles. Made by someone. Father's mother? No contact was allowed later on. It was mother's choice to leave everything. Grandmother's, snow. All water ice returns to the breath of the world. But those cast-off mittens might still be somewhere. Evidence of a boy's existence. I told Mrs. Brown it was my first Christmas gift in over 10 years. In our many days together, she has not betrayed such emotion as that confession invoked. 10 year, and not one soul to give you a measly gifty? My family's all gone. But people! In Mexico, you worked in homes, did you not? The last ones were Russian. They didn't pay Christmas any notice. Mr. Trotsky had us work through like any other day. He didn't hold with our Lord Jesus. He was a good man, but no, he didn't. He was Jewish, his background. He's the one that got killed? Yes. And the ones before that? All Jews? No, Mrs. Rivera was crazy for Christmas. She always organized feasts. I was the cook. So you had to work straight through. I did. Mr. Shepherd, it pains me to be gone away next week. Honestly, I'm glad you asked. You need to go see your family, and I need to be reminded what regular people do at holiday times. Well, regular, I wouldn't know. But you'll have naught here to tell you it's Christmas. What will you do? What will an acorn do when it has lain a while in the ground and the rain swells its husk? Become a fig? I said, I have the galley proofs to finish. Now, Mr. Shepherd, that is a fib. You finished those, and I know it. I wanted to have one more look, and then I'll start writing something new. The eyebrows soared. What about? I'm not sure. She gathered up her purse and gloves, preparing to go. A light snow had been falling all day. All work and no play, Mr. Shepherd, makes the meat go to gristle. Does it? I thought it made Jack a dull boy. It would do that as well. I'll probably get nothing done at all, thanks to the pile of books you brought from the library. I'll poke up the fire and have Christmas with Mr. Hardy and Mr. Dickens. What could be better? And Tristram Shandy. The cats are hinting that I should cook a leg of lamb, so maybe I will. And I'm sure Eddie Cantor and Nora Martin will sing some carols for me on Wednesday night. I hate to tell you, but they're singing for their sponsor. I think it's Sal Hepatica. You are cruel, Mrs. Brown. Next you'll tell me all those girls on the Lucky Strike hit parade are crooning for Lucky Strike cigarettes and not me. She sat with her hands on her pocketbook, waiting. You want to say something? Go ahead. None of my business, Mr. Shepherd. But a man would have a girl, usually. Or attachments. That aren't cats or books. I took off the gloves and folded them carefully. Now, this is really a case of the skillet calling the kettle black. 30 years is a long time to stay a widow. I did have a runny go at marriage, the one time. Well, don't worry. I've had my runny goes. Attachments, as you say. If you say so, and no Christmas present for 10 years. If you get attached to something, seems like it wouldn't come all that far loose. No, wait, I forgot. Last Christmas, Romulus brought over a jam cake from his mother. Half the cake, actually.
He said they'd had enough of it.
Blessed are the grateful, Mr. Shepherd, but that is no account as a real present. Half a jam cake showing signs of prior use.
Chispa slipped into the room, around the edge of the door and along the wall, flattened to it as if pulled sideways by a separate order of gravity. Slowly she crossed the bottom of the bookcase in similar manner, into the ingle nook by the fireplace. I unfolded the gloves. It was tempting to put them on, wear them until Whitsuntide. Mrs. Brown, I'm not the sort of person who attracts gifts.
Mr. Shepherd, do you think I believe it? I open the mail with all such things in it as people can let sail, even little embroidered things.
Then I should say I'm not a good recipient. When people are no good at relationships, I've noticed they often blame the other people, but I don't.
I've never heard you blame a soul for anything, Mr. Shepherd. It's one of your qualities, to the extent I sometimes wonder if your mother dropped you on your head.
No, she probably carried me in a suitcase. She was eternally on the move. Anyone I especially liked was soon gone, household people or friends. It's been like that. Or they've left me on their own initiative, mostly by dying.
Well, I am not a one to argue with mortal demise.
Well said, Mrs. Brown.
You ought to write it down, about yourself and all those that went away.
What, write about my life? Like poor old Tristram Shandy trying to remember his whole story, helter-skelter?
You'd get further, she said. You've been keeping good notes all along.
Who would want to read such trivial stuff?
Well, why write it down in the first place, then?
Because you do. I'm not putting my nose into anything. You do it plain in the open, Mr. Shepherd.
Seems to me, if you really wanted shed of your own days, you'd not take such care to put them all down on a page. I see you go so deep in it, you forget day or night and have breakfast at supper.
I'm just a writer. It's my way of thinking.
It's your attachments. That's what it looks like to me. You might do as well to attach to your own self, alongside all these story people you dream up from nowhere.
But who would want to read that?
The light outside had gone dusky, and now the wind raised a low keen against the window. Clumps of snow fell out of the trees, shattering across the yard. You won't want to miss your 5:15 bus, I said. She donned a formidable knitted hat and stood to leave, reaching to shake my hand. I will see you on Monday week. Happy Christmas, Mr. Shepherd.
Happy Christmas, Mrs. Brown. I thank you for the gift.
She closed the door and stepped out toward Haywood, leaving behind a house as silent as an underworld. Chisme slipped into the room, pulled by the same sidelong gravity across the bottom of the wall into the ingle nook. Chispa immediately left it then, according to the inscrutable laws of attraction and indifference. The hall clock divided the scene into measured increments. Tick, tick. Who would want to read all this? Kingsport News, March 2, 1947. Book Review by United Press. Picture the lady walking by, a real looker, gold bangles on her arm and a tattoo on her ankle. She's headed out for some shopping with a basket strapped on her back. For today's menu, she may choose iguana roasted on the spit or perhaps armadillo. For cash, her gal pals trade cocoa beans or a handy gadget that's the rage with their better halves here in ancient Mexico, a double-edged throwing spear called the Atl Atl. That's the opening scene of Pilgrims of Chapultepec, a novel by Harrison Shepherd that reads like a joyride.
This tribe of ancients will settle down in village life for only so long before it loses its charm to pox, invasion, or bandits. You can count on it. Then they hit the trail again, goaded on by a wild-eyed king who claims he'll lead them to a promised land. How will they know when they've found it? He claims the gods told him to look for an eagle on a cactus, snacking on a snake. Apart from its forehead wrinkle of a title, this book aims to please hair-raising battles, narrow escapes, and a heaping portion of adventure in a tale of hard-nosed leaders and men who suffer them. The Evening Post, March 8, 1947. Books for Thought by Sam Hall Mitchell. The Quick and the Dead. Author Harrison Shepard, the diffident but talented prodigy who last year brought us Vassals of Majesty, has another winning turn based on historical fact in ancient Mexico. In Pilgrims of Chapultepec, the Aztec people are driven from their ancestral home in a journey with more twists than a Chinaman's queue. By its end, the author has tackled some surprising themes, including the atom bomb question. These pilgrims hike for decades, pushed by a mad king who always promises happiness is just around the bend. The author's Studs Lonigan is an Indian youth named Poatli Q, watched by the jealous king as he hones his skill in battle. Golden boy Poatli Q was singled out by the gods at 13 to hurl the first atl-atl, a razor-sharp flying weapon put in the hero's hand as he was about to die in his first battle. In a new world deus ex machina, the weapon was carried to the hero by an eagle. The ruthless king fears an upstart's power to unseat him and offers a bargain. If Poatli Q maintains his loyalty without a hitch, he'll someday help rule the nation. But someday never comes, and Poatli Q grows a cynical stripe, doubting the value of following an unwise leader. On dark nights, he wonders if the gods chose him for a reason, to behead the sniveling king and rule in his place. Poatli Q even questions the seductive power of his atl-atl. His tribesmen revere it as a god, rushing to make replicas of the weapon, worshipping it on an altar, believing it will grant them absolute rule. But Poatli Q notes a worrisome trend. As his tribesmen reproduce the blade's design, so do their enemies. Having perfected it, they fashion harsher weapons. With each battle, the death numbers grow higher, the killing tools more precise. Just as we've lately been warned by Bernard Baruch's somber report to Congress, these pilgrims must choose between the quick and the dead, when fate gives them a dread power without means to stop its baleful use. Baruch argues for disposal of all atom bombs, while author Shepard only calls the reader to wonder until the final page, has the sacred weapon saved those who wield it or doomed them? The Asheville Trumpet, April 8, 1947. Asheville Rider, A Mystery by Carl Nicholas. Here where mountain air is clearest and heaven is the nearest, our most prominent writer gives a taste of faraway places in Pilgrims of Chaltipica, a new book flying off the shelves this month of every bookstore in the nation. Mrs. Jack Cates, owner of Cates Bookshop, tells us Harrison Shepard knows the ropes of his trade, and this book will not disappoint. "We had a hubbub the week it came in," she said. "Nobody wants to read anything but... And I'm going to warn you, it's got more bear skin in it than a hot day at Beaver Lake." The author bases his books on his own experience growing up in Mexico, but has resided in the Montford Hills neighborhood since 1941. Calls from the trumpet have not been returned. Mrs. Cates speculates he may regard his privacy as... She calls him the most eligible bachelor in town, if not North Carolina. At the Asheville Skating Club next door to the bookstore, 21 comely lasses partook of our survey on the subject, with 15 saying they are hep to shepherd, but definitely. 6 maintained otherwise, spooky and cold cut among the reasons given. 9 young ladies say they hold it against him for not serving in the armed forces due to a 4F status, but the others say it was not his fault due to a perforated eardrum, the condition shared with crooner Frank Sinatra. All wondered how a well-heeled single fellow spends his time, as the author has sold nearly 1 million copies. As the old Asheville saying goes, our moonshine is the meanest, our stories are the keenest, our sportsmen are the gamest, and, so it seems, our bachelors are the tamest. The Echo, April 26, 1947. Pilgrims of Chapultepec by Harrison W. Shepherd. $2.69, Stratford and Sons, New York. Don't look now, but a new chump named Harrison W. Shepherd is more popular than Wendell Willkie. His Pilgrims of Chapultepec is storming the nation this month and sure to be translated abroad. Don't be surprised one day if you hear they're reading Harrison Shepherd in China. This one will be snapped up by the movies, so read it now before you see the picture. The glittering backdrop of Mexico spreads across every page, and the young hero is a heartthrob with good looks and a secret weapon to boot. Ladies, this one will break your heart. Will this author ever give us a happy ending? Shepherd slathers emotion on the page, yet in real life he is a shy fellow who guards against any showing of his feelings. A friend who's known him since college days revealed this mental reserve goes back to Shepherd's short pants days, when even at his mother's funeral he remained cool as ice. However, our source revealed old friend Harry has one curious quirk. He cannot look at a beautiful woman without whistling. April 30th. It was the perforated eardrum that put the pepper on Mrs. Brown, and the whistling at girls. "This friend from college days," she asked, "is that a person?" "I don't think so, given that I didn't go to college. The people of my past are dead and gone, Mrs. Brown. That's a fact." Billy Boorsey's huge hands, both of us suffocating with laughter, trying to keep still. An officer's footsteps outside in the hall, pounding hearts, scarlet shame. "Well, who would reckon? The papers make things up out of the blue sky." "Or they find a little rain cloud and help it along." She hesitated in the doorway, backlit from the upstairs hall in her square-shouldered, putty-colored suit. Platform shoes with ankle straps, oh my, and hair let out of its net today, pinned at the sides and curled at the shoulders, longer than I remembered. She looks like a tiny, earnest Jane Russell. Lately it's crossed my mind to wonder if there is some fellow. She takes a midday break for errands and a bite in one of the luncheonettes on Charlotte. She could be meeting a sailor for all I know. "Mr. Shepherd, when you see a thing like this in print, people think it's true. I almost think it myself, and that's me knowing better. How can they do it?" "Somehow they manage every day of the year. Why be surprised just because this time the victim is me?" She stayed in the doorway. She doesn't like to come in the study for fear of disturbing. "Mr. Shepherd, why are you not? A shocking thing ought to shock." A shocking thing. "The man I worked for in Mexico, I don't even know how to tell you what the newsmen did to him. One night some gunmen broke into the house and attacked him with machine guns, attacked all of us, the staff and his family. His grandson got hurt. We were terrified they'd come back. But the press said Lev had organized this attack himself to get sympathy for his cause. They reported that as fact." "My stars."
It didn't help us get police protection, I can tell you. And that's just one thing, a case that comes to mind. The other man I worked for reportedly ate human flesh.
Well, that's Mexican newspapers. We want to think ours are better here, but I suppose they say the same about us.
It was all over everywhere, about Trotsky staging the shooting attack. Europe, New York. It starts in one paper, and that's the source. The others pick it up and pass it along. Lev used to say there are two kinds of papers, the ones that lie every day and the ones that save it for special campaigns for greater impact.
But a perforated eardrum, my stars. It's like you said. It starts with one and then it goes. We've not heard the end of that one.
Like howler monkeys.
Mr. Shepherd, the Trumpet's your own hometown. They could have asked.
If they had called, what would you have said?
She looked like a model standing for a portrait of misery. Shoulders squared, high eyebrows knit, hands tightly folded. I would do as you ask. Mr. Shepherd has no comment to make on that.
Thank you.
But? When they have nothing, they fill in. If you don't stop them, they fill in more. It's like you've agreed to it. To their way of thinking, saying nothing is the same as agreeing.
Are you saying it's my responsibility to stop another man from lying?
Well, no. It's his to stop himself.
Dios habla por el que calla.
Meaning what, Mr. Shepherd?
God speaks for the man who keeps quiet.
If you say so.
No comment means no comment. It does not mean, I hate to admit this, but yes, he has a punctured eardrum.
Well, people think that. And taking the fifth means you're guilty.
Whatever they may think, it does not. A blank space on a form, the missing page, a void, a hole in your knowledge of someone, it's still some real thing, Mrs. Brown. It exists. You don't get to fill it in with whatever you want. I'm staking myself on a principle. This country promises us the presumption of innocence.
Presumptions we have got, Mr. Shepherd, coming out our ears.
What would you have me say? Mr. Shepherd does not have a punctured eardrum. He does not have a friend from college days. He does look at pretty girls without whistling. Oh, that's a trap. Where does it stop?
She had no answer.
If the atl-atl was meant as a symbol for the atom bomb, can't we let the reader have a chance to decide?
Well, I know what you're saying.
The reporters would have you put in the grinder and feed you to baby with a spoon. I don't think the reporters really want to know the first thing about me. They fancy themselves artists. They'd rather draw freehand.
They do have questions.
I know. The one fellow wanted to ask me about Truman and the Soviet containment policy, remember? Collier's, I think.
New York Times. Collier's said they wouldn't even run a review unless you spoke to them.
And did they?
A little one. It wasn't very good.
If I talked, I would only end up giving them more blanks to fill in. How do you feel about Truman's new anti-Soviet position, Mr. Shepherd? No comment. That Betty Davis is quite a looker, isn't she, Mr. Shepherd? No comment.
So, the punctured eardrum? No comment?
Correct.
Next they'll be reporting you died.
Imagine the peace and quiet.
The telephone rang, and she ran to get it. Her stockings had seams down the backs.
I tried out a wolf whistle, a feeble one, but I heard her pause on the stairs.
A sample of the mail received May 15, 1947, 75 letters in all.
After publication of Pilgrims of Chapultepec, Stratford and Sons posted the mail forward in boxes once or twice weekly. V.B.
Dear Mr. Shepherd, at the youthful age of 70, here is one codger who tips my hat to you. For years I have reread the favorites because the new authors are not up to snuff. But some weeks ago I ran short and went to my corner bookstore for a suggestion. The fellow handed me two by Harrison W. Shepherd, a name unknown to me. I read both without a pause. Of course, I blush at scenes of copulation and revelry, but you show that modern times are no different from the old, and people the same everywhere. I was stationed overseas in the First War and never learned to like it, but it did teach me a thing or two. Thank you for adding spunk to my life. I look forward to your other books. Sincerely, Colin Thomas.
Dear Mr. Shepherd, although we have never met, I consider you a friend. You touch and inspire me. I read Vassals of Majesty twice, and now the new one. Thank you for putting my own heart into words. I have wanted to show courage the way your characters do. You show that men at the top don't always have any more smarts than the rest of us. I have been thinking of telling my boss to jump in the lake and look for better. Secretary. Now I just might achieve my goal. With admiration, Lynn Hill.
Dear Mr. Shepherd, I had to read your book in history at Lancaster Valley High. I don't read too many books, but yours is okay. It gave me a lot to ponder about Potley Q wanting to be a good citizen and then ending up wanting to kill the king. Our teacher said to ask you three questions about ancient times of Mexico for our report. My questions. Number one, is it true the eagle gave the people their first weapon? Number two, what kind of government did they have, democracy or dictator? Number three, did you ever really shoot a deer? Thank you. My report is due May 12th. Yours truly, Wendell Dixon.
This is one of 19 letters enclosed in a single packet from Lancaster Valley High School, California, V.B. Dear Mr. Harrison Shepherd, my heart is full of happiness just knowing you are holding this letter in your hand. Thank you for being an author. You have gotten me through a lot of sad times when my mother died, especially. Sometimes I do everything I can just to get through the day so I can curl up at night with my favorite book. When life is humdrum or just plain old sad, I know you will take me away to the place where troubles are forgotten. When I get a letter back from you, my life will be complete. Thank you. Thank you. Yours, Roxanne Wills. All correspondence answered in the same week received, insofar as possible. No photographs or inclusions. V.B. June 6, 1947. Dear Frida, Diego's telegram has terrified me not a little. He seems to believe the doctors nearly killed you, so I fear for all concerned, but for you above all. I'm determined today to send a cheerful letter, to give you a little picnic from your worries, as you have done often for me. You'll find in this package your birthday present. Don't be too disappointed. It's only another book, which I hope will amuse you. If not, blame yourself. You should have left me a cook. I am trying to begin a new story that will be about the Mayans, I think, and the fall of civilizations. Everyone wants a happy ending this time, so this should be just the ticket. But the writing proceeds slowly when life is filled with such thrilling distractions. Only last week, I purchased a packet of clothespins and a new billfold. The shop girl informed me it has a secret pouch. The roadster and I make a date to lubricate every 30 days at the garage on Cox Avenue. A new appliance shop has opened down the street. And right now, I am spying out my study window into the treetops where a gigantic bird is pecking a hole. I wish you could see the creature. Its red hair stands straight up, as mine does on Mondays. Goodness, the wood chips fly. This thing is the size of an ox. And you were worried my life was dull. I never want for company. The neighbor boy, Romulus, seems to prefer my house to his own, now that summer is here and he is paroled from grade 6. With hands shoved deep in overall pockets, he wanders around the house coveting things, but is not a thief. He asks. He particularly wants the little carved idol from Teotihuacan. I haven't told him it's a stolen object. Instead, I gave him a fountain pen and an old fedora, and he pretends to be Edward Murrow, using a doomsday voice to interview the cats. I also offered to give him a cat, the useless black one I call Chisme, but he won't take it. My stenographer comes Monday through Friday to answer mail and telephone for over a year now. My wonderful amanuensis. She works at the dining room table. With each fresh day's mail piled high there, we pray, "For what we are about to receive, may the Lord make us truly thankful." She is a whiz. I have known her sometimes to get through nearly 100 letters from readers in a day, typing up a kind little note in answer to each. She hauls it all to the post office in a gigantic leather satchel she found somewhere, such as might have been used by the Pony Express. Over her shoulder she slings it, and off she goes, does Violet Brown. I can't help thinking you would appreciate the irony of her name, for she is a dove-gray little bird. And something like the mother I need, commanding me to leave the house for fresh air at least once daily, if only to the corner for cigarettes. Lately, she has stepped up the program. I am to undertake some level of social adventure each week. Going to the movies by myself is acceptable. Mrs. Brown is lenient. And not too bad if I slip in after the house has gone dark. The purpose of the outings is to overcome my dread of the world and all things in it. Now the magazines are saying I have a punctured eardrum, which is helpful. If the world howls too loudly, I can pretend I don't hear. Please send word you are recovering. Diego's telegram was a shocker. He seems extremely angry, not only with your doctors, but also the world and every damn gringo in it. Myself included. You might let him know, Truman did not consult me before committing to defeat the communists in Greece and Turkey. Secretary of State Marshall has announced a new plan for European assistance that won't thrill your husband either. Frida, you understand men. How are these leaders different from the boys I used to watch at school trying to make up their teams for football? Before this war, we had 6 great players on the grass. Now only 2 are left standing. Naturally, those 2 will be rivals and try to get the rest to line up on their side. Dimes and candy will help, sure. I struggle to understand why Diego supports Stalin now, after working so closely with Lev and even seeing him murdered. What rational motives could cause Diego to make this change? It's a revolutionary necessity, he said. But how am I to know what that means? Betrayal as the means to an end? Nearly every day I wake up shocked at how little in this world I comprehend. Perhaps Diego is right, and despite all my years of serving brilliant men, I am only a dumb gringo. I shall try to keep to the task I seem to know, writing stories for people who believe if you throw a rock, it could roll uphill. If your husband says I am an idiot on the subject of politics, certainly he should know. So don't ask me about the peaceful atom or how to raise the birth rate in France. For your amusement, I enclose a newspaper review, a favorite from the last round. I take it as proof I am no literary great, but Mrs. Brown says it proves my books are about important things. Diego may take it as written proof that someone here besides myself opposes Truman's shocking turn against the rising proletariat. but mostly it proves nothing. You know reviewers, they are the wind in their own sails. I should like to write my books only for the dear person who lies awake reading in bed until page last, then lets the open book fall gently on her face to touch her smile or drink her tears. I'm not brave as you are. However badly broken, you still stand up. In your Tijuana dresses, in your garden, with the pomegranate trees bending toward you to open their red flowers, no matter what happens, you will still be at the center of the world. Your friend, Insólito. The New York Weekly Review, April 26, 1947. Author's Second Strike Hits the Mark, by Donald Brewer. Do not mistake Harrison Shepherd for a literary great. His stories are full to brimming with lusty, bare-chested youths. The settings are glamorous, the plots chest-heavers. You may not admit it to your friends, but somehow you can't put them down. Pilgrims of Chapultepec, Stratford and Sons, set in Mexico before the conquest, recounts a pilgrimage of people cast out from home, doomed to follow a neurotic leader who picks fights with his own shadow. Shepherd makes the case for those who find themselves on the ropes against bad policy, wondering what the Sam Hill their leader could be thinking. The protagonist, a boy named Poatly Q, struggles to be a model citizen, but comes to view his nation's long march as a winning game for the king and the scourge of everyone else. Author Shepherd combines leather-stocking action with Chaplin-esque pathos, as shown in this symbolic hunting scene. Poatly Q and his friend skin a deer, grousing about the king as they hack their kill into anatomical bits. Their leader has made another outrageous edict, reversing a treaty of friendship with a neighboring clan, deciding now it can't be trusted. The tribe will have to move again in a season when food is scarce. These youths are rankled. Poatly Q tosses a pair of testicles in the dust, calling them the buck's last big hopes in sad little bags. He tells his pal, "Our leader is an empty sack. You could just as well knock him over, put a head with horns on a stick, and follow that. Most of us never choose to believe in the nation. We just come up short on better ideas. It's probably a law. The public imagination may not exceed the size of the leader's bollocks." The author may be alluding here to the testimony of Donald Benedict, the New York theological student who refused to register for the draft during the war. Benedict said during the trial, "We do not contend that the American people maliciously choose the vicious instrument of war. But in a perplexing situation, they lack the imagination and religious faith to respond in a different manner." Does Shepherd mean to put himself in the draft dodgers' camp? One could ask many questions of this politically astute novelist, starting with his opinion of a leader who has just set the nation reeling with an abrupt foreign policy reversal, from friendly cooperation to Truman's so-called containment of the USSR. We can only wonder, as Shepherd declines to be interviewed. But this week, as we line up behind our man in Washington, shelling up $400 million to fight our friends of yesterday because, as he says, every nation must choose, we might listen for a thump in the dust and wonder whether the public's big hopes will fit in that small, sad sack. June 11th. She has raised the subject of the memoir yet again. I thought it had died a natural death, but no, she presses. If only to put to rest the perforated eardrum question, I suspect. The first chapter was very good, in her opinion, and today she confessed that since the day I gave it to her, she comes to work each morning hoping I'll have the next part of it ready for her to type. "It's been near 6 months now since Chapter 1, Mr. Shepherd. If it takes that long for each, you'll not outlive your own boyhood." I told her I was very sorry to crush her hopes in coming to work and so forth, but there will be no next part. It was a direly mistaken idea. And anyway, even several months ago when I was entertaining the project, I'd run across a problem, the missing notebook. The very next little diary after the first one. I hadn't yet told her. "I can't recall that year without it," I said. "I should have let you know a while ago. I just hoped you'd forget about it. The memoir fell apart before I'd even gotten started."
"What do you mean, gone?"
Her eye went to the shelf. She knows where I keep them. They should all be put to the flame. "The crucial missing piece of the manuscript. There's a word for that historians use. A lacuna. So blame it on fate and history if you want." She asked, "Did you have it before? When you first took all of them out of the crate?" "This is not a set of keys gone missing," I informed her with some irritation. "It just didn't come with the rest when Frida packed up the notebooks and papers. Probably it had burned at the police station or slipped behind a cabinet. It's small. I know exactly what it looked like. It was a little leather-bound accounts book I stole from the maid, about the size of your hand. And now it's gone. Just forget about the memoir. I'm working on something different now. I should burn up all these notebooks so you'll stop nagging me about it."
"Mrs. Brown is no fool." She said, "If you remember what the booklet looked like, you could remember well enough what was in it."
June 23rd. It was only one letter, but she carried it up the stairs like a sack of bricks. "I hate to disturb, but it says they need this back by return mail."
"Who is it?"
"J. Parnell Thomas. Friend or foe?" "Chairman, House Committee on Un-American Activities, formerly known as the Dyes Committee."
"Rings a bell."
"Yes. Oh, yes, I know these gentlemen. Comité Diez, we'd pronounced it, like 10 in Spanish. They arranged Lev's trip to Washington, the visas all prepared and then canceled at the last minute."
"You do?"
She seemed startled. "I mean, I know what they do. They called up my former employer once from Mexico to testify on the treacheries of Stalin. They're still in business?" She held up the letter. "It's just a form. They say it's gone out to all employees of the Department of State."
"I don't believe I'll be shipping any more art for the government."
"Present or previous, it says. They need you to sign a statement saying you're loyal to the United States government."
"Goodness, why wouldn't I be?"
She moved her glasses from her head to her nose and read, "Due to close wartime cooperation between the United States and Russia, certain strategic areas of our government may have been opened to communist sympathizers. As of March 21, 1947, the President and Congress have undertaken to secure the loyalty of all government workers."
"Very cloak and dagger. Where do I sign?"
She approached the bench. "Are you sure you ought, Mr. Shepherd? If you aren't looking to work for the government again, maybe there isn't need."
"Are you doubting my loyalty?"
She surrendered the letter for signature.
"Mrs. Brown, I don't hate much and I don't love much. I'm a free man, but I love writing books for Americans. Look at those letters, all that sky blue goodness. This country is the berries. And Joseph Stalin murdered my friend. He would have gotten me, too, if I'd stood in the way."
"So you've said, Mr. Shepherd. I know it sets a haint upon you, especially of an August, and no wonder. It's no small thing to see bloody murder." I signed the letter and handed it back. I told her, "I'm inclined in this case to stand out of the way. If I ever had to choose, I might just be a coward and save my own skin."
"That's people," she said. "That's how the good Lord made us to be."
"No, I've known brave men. Lev saw his children murdered and never gave in. Even young boys like Sheldon Hart. I'm told they loved life even more than I do. It's why they became revolutionaries and ended up bludgeoned or dead in a lime pit. She stood waiting. For a happier ending, I suppose. Mrs. Brown, what we end up calling history is a kind of knife slicing down through time. A few people are hard enough to bend its edge, but most won't even stand close to the blade. I'm one of those. We don't bend anything. You do, though. Look here. I've got boxes of letters downstairs, as you said yourself. People telling how you've saved their day. Do you think that's ordinary? I give them a lark. A few hours to forget about a disappointing family or a boss who's a tyrant. But all that mess is still there when the book ends. I don't save people. The corners of her mouth turned down. Mr. Shepherd, here's your trouble. You don't know your own strength. July 3rd. The Pack Square soda shop could not have been decked out with more flag bunting if it were the president's train car. Romulus was dazzled, mostly by his buffalo-like ice cream sundae. Mrs. Brown was rosy-cheeked, sipping cola through a straw. "You ought to be thrilled," she said. "A Hollywood movie." "You keep saying that. I am thrilled." "Well, you barely look it," she said. She had on the blue Carybrook beret, wear it many ways, identifying this as a social adventure of the highest order. "You don't," Romulus agreed. "You pipe down. We men have to stick together. We don't wear our hearts on our sleeves the way women do." He glanced at his shoulder, then took a white cap of cream off his cheek with the back of a hand. "It's not really settled yet, for one thing. Where am I going to find an agent?" "Now, did Mr. Lincoln say you have to get one, or just that it would be helpful? What did he say about that exactly?" "Find someone to negotiate the contract for the motion picture option. He can't do it. This is between Hollywood and me. An agent is customary, or a lawyer." "Well, lawyers, I have known a few. Working for the city. Not that they could reckon out a motion picture contract." "Mr. Lincoln said brace ourselves for the press. They'll step up the pursuit." A pea-green Cadillac hunched past like some kind of water animal, the small split windshield like close-set eyes. They will never make another car to touch the roadster. "Mrs. Brown put us in a corner near the window so I wouldn't be spotted in the shop, but even so, I could hear a couple of girls at the counter saying, 'Him! It is! Isn't!'" Mrs. Brown snapped her fingers. "I have a man! I think I have the business card in my jewelry case!" For a moment she sounded so modern, a regular gal Friday. "And she saves the day once again. Or might have. We will see. It's a gentleman she met last year when he came to inquire about renting a vacant room. They had quite a chat in the parlor while waiting for Mrs. Biddle to return from the hairdresser's. He's from New York City, a lawyer, mostly retired, moving to Asheville because his wife had died and the daughter Margaret lived here. Grandchildren. He was not sure how he'd get along in Dixieland, but you can't argue with a daughter named Margaret. Even Harry Truman knows that, ha ha." They'd had the radio on in the parlor, and Mrs. Brown happened to wonder aloud what the stars looked like. The voices give a certain impression, but the actors might be less attractive than they sound. It was Duffy's Tavern. The gentleman told her, as a matter of fact, the actress playing Duffy's daughter might sound like a girl, but she is a mature woman, 40 if she's a day. Shirley Booth. And the other one, Cass Daly, has an overbite like a lizard. How did he know? He's met them, that's how. It's his line, a radio and television lawyer. I asked Mrs. Brown why he hadn't taken the room. Miss Biddle wouldn't let to him. She was sorry. He seemed very nice.
I see. Only good people here. Was he a Negro?
No.
Just too much of a Yankee?
She glanced at Romulus, then back at me. You told me in Mexico you used to work for some that didn't have Christmas.
Even the word Christmas didn't jog a glimmer of attention from Romulus. He sat glaze-eyed as a mystic, stirring his bowl of ice cream soup streaked with a bleeding cherry. I tried to work out the puzzle.
Oh, this man was a Jew?
Arthur Gold, the New York Jew in Dixie.